For Black History Month in February 2009, Canada Post issued a stamp honoring Rosemary Brown. Do you think they really knew who she was?
One of the things I really love about being black, it's been so good for me in terms of preparing me for the women's revolution.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Rosemary Brown died at the age of 72. Born in Jamaica, Brown immigrated to Canada as a young woman, earned a master's degree in social work, and became the first black woman elected to a Canadian legislature. She served in the British Columbia Provincial Assembly for 14 years and ran second in her party's leadership race in 1974. Her influence is widely acknowledged by other women in politics. After leaving the legislature, Brown continued to make her mark as a feminist. From 1989 to 1991, she was the first executive director of the Ottawa-based Match International Center, an organization run by and for women from the poorest areas of the world. She stayed involved with Match for the rest of her life, but also went on to be a newspaper columnist and a professor of women's studies. One of Brown's many witty and incisive speeches aired on Wings in 1992, her keynote address to a conference on women in the media, organized by the Canadian Association of Journalists.
Please welcome Rosemary Brown.
Let me start out by telling you that I have been surprised by the lack of analysis in this group. No analysis about what sexism really is. No analysis about what feminism is really all about. A lot of narrative, a lot of people talking about their experiences, but no sense of really what it all means. I mean, what is sexism? What is its function? What is its role in our society? If it had no function and it had no role, in the 20 years since the second wave of the women's liberation movement, we would have been able to eliminate it. We would have been able to wipe it out. The fact that we haven't been able to do so should have raised in everybody's mind some questions about what it is all about. Because the reality of the situation is that sexism plays a very important part in our society. It has a function, it has a role. It is no different to racism, ageism, homophobia, you know, discrimination against people who are disabled or whatever. There is a reason for it. And there is a reason why it resists and persists despite every effort to eradicate it. But I did not perceive, either in the workshops which I attended or the plenary, that there was any analysis, any sense of understanding about this. Let us start, for example, with the question of backlash. The sense I got from the workshop this morning, where it was an issue which was raised and discussed at great length, was that this is something which happens to individuals in individual newsrooms, not so much we are told in television, certainly in the radio and other areas. Backlash is not spontaneous. It's not superficial. Neither is it new. Backlash is attendant on any attempt to remedy forms of prejudice and discrimination. That is what it's all about. If there is no backlash, that means you're not really having any effect. That's really what it means. So backlash is a signal that it's working. And the more effective the change becomes, the greater the backlash. So it seems to me that you need to have an understanding about backlash. You need to analyze it and to know really what it's all about. You need to know its roots. You need to know the reason why it exists. And you need to know why it resists every attempt to end it. I suggest that the first thing that you do is to embark on this process of analysis. We really do need it. Because when you do, you will find that backlash is rooted in economic, the social, religious, educational, and all other facets of the socialization of males and females in our society. That's how endemic it is. Like a brain tumor, it may respond to short-term or superficial remedies, but that is not going to cure it. It has to be taken seriously. It is not a joke. It is not something which disappears if it is ignored. It has a function. It is there to intimidate. It is there to derail. It is there to detour. It is there to scare you off from what you're doing. And if you back off now because you are upset and hurt and terrified by the backlash, then what you will have done is hurt the efforts of every woman, not just in British Columbia, not just in Canada, but every woman everywhere who's ever fought for equality for women. That's what you'd be doing. Backlash hurts. It is painful. It is uncomfortable. What it says to us is that somebody doesn't love us because of what we're doing. That's the price we have to pay. Because whether we like the word or not, what we really are embarked on when we talk about equality for women is a revolution. You know, we use that word in song, courtesy of Tracy Chapman, but we don't like to use it in real life. But that's what we're into. And if we're not prepared to do that, then we should do what Nicole Parton suggests and find a man and become a loving cook. Because that's the alternative to what we're trying to do. I want to tell you that there has never been in the history of the world, not since we've had writing anyway, in any culture, a level playing field. It's never existed. Contrary to what George Bush and the other people may want to tell you, there has never been a level playing field. In every culture, in every country, in every society, since the beginning of time, there has been a form of affirmative action. It's never been called that. And I personally regret the day when we gave a name to it. But there has always been preferential treatment for some people. Always. Think about it. What we have now is an attempt on the part of women to shift that preferential treatment in our society, away from white Anglo-Saxon males to women, and is creating havoc. And any man who is not threatened by affirmative action and by the pursuit of equality on the part of women is a fool. Because in fact, what we are doing is trying to create a level playing field, is trying to bring women onto the playing field where they've never been before. And you can't do that and still maintain the privilege of a few. Men have never had to deal with decisions based on fairness and competence and who is the best person for the job. Because always immediately in every competition, women were automatically eliminated. They weren't to be considered. Now they are. So there are more people competing for fewer places. The competition is getting rough. And the guys are finding, as they should, that it's not as easy to get to the top as it used to be. And I want to tell you who is really hurting. It's the younger men. The older men have nothing to fear. There are no women up there competing with them. And anyway, they are more concerned about opening doors of opportunity and keeping them open now so that their daughters can get through. So all of a sudden, they become the good guys. And we really love them. They have nothing to lose. But the young men do. And if in the process of competing, they are using tactics and techniques which we consider to be unfair, such as harassment, we should recognize that these are weapons of desperation. That's what they are. The important thing, though, for us to keep in mind is that we must not be deterred. We must not be detoured. We have a saying in the black movement, and one of the things I really love about being black is the civil rights movement, because it's been so good for me in terms of preparing me for the women's revolution, among other things. And our saying is, keep your eyes on the prize. It's amazing what you can do when you keep your eyes on your goal, when you're focused. Suddenly, the other stuff is just whizzing by you. You don't sweat the small stuff. You really mustn't. Because it drains your energy. It really does. It takes the most valuable thing you have, which is time, away from the real work which you have to do. And you have to do it. Whether you like it or not, women in this country are depending on you as women in the movement, as women in the media, to help us get this revolution won. We do want to be equal. And we want to be equal in our lifetime. I can't be bothered to think about milk and honey when I die. I don't like milk. I don't drink it. You know, and I'm not that keen on honey either. I want to be equal now. My final off-the-cuff comment has to do with the memory gap. And I take full blame for this. And if you were one of my children, you would groan when I say that, because you know that the guilt trip is about to begin. Whenever I say to my kids, okay, I take full blame for this, they say, Mother, don't, please. But I believe that we as older feminists have to. We have not done a good enough job of passing on the story of our struggle to the younger women who have been coming along after us. You know, the Simaholes and the June Callwoods and the Shirley Chargers and the Rosemary Browns and women like us who remember what it was like 30 years and 40 years ago and understood what we were fighting for when we started this war. And I shouldn't use, I'm a pacifist, I don't believe in war. I mean, when we started this, we haven't done a good enough job of telling our children and our grandchildren what it was like. Nor have we done a good enough job of sharing with them our dream about what equality is all about. And I was really moved in the plenary this afternoon when one of the women stood up, and she spoke for me when she said, before you decide to talk about, let us talk and let us dialogue, you try and find out what we went through 30 years ago and what started this whole process. And I'm afraid that what we have is a generation of young women coming along who are not naive so much as they're ignorant. And we have to take some responsibility for that. Because they're not going to carry on the struggle, and they're not going to go through to the very end in terms of equality, because they don't understand how bad it used to be or where we started from. So we have to get our act together too. And it's boring. I know what it's like when you have to sit and listen to someone say, in my day. But somehow or another, maybe using the talent of the Kathleen Shannons of the world or whatever, we've got to get that message out there. They've got to know how far behind we were, and they've got to know where we want to go to. Because if we don't get that message across, then they are going to have to go through the whole process again themselves. And we would quite literally have wasted our entire lifetimes. And that is just too depressing even to contemplate. Now, you have a choice. Those were my off-the-cuff remarks. I can end it right here, or I can read you the very boring speech which I prepared for tonight. Okay. I was just manipulating you. Because really what I want to talk about is the relationship between women and the media and women in this country of ours. And because increasingly I tend to look at the experiences of women in an international context, some of my comments will reflect this bias. Both groups, women in the media and women in the community at large, have been profoundly affected by the women's movement of the 60s. And it is fair to observe two things. One, that women in the media have contributed greatly to the success of the ongoing women's revolution in Canada. And two, that women in the media have in turn benefited from the ongoing women's revolution in Canada. Some of you here may have been in the business long enough to recall what it was like in the pre-1960s, when women first began to assert their right to be treated as equal. Because observation reveals that even more of you could not possibly have been around at that time, I will just wander briefly with you down memory lane. I will first remind you that since this is my memory, it may differ somewhat from yours, but as an addicted media observer and participant in some of the activities which were of interest to the media at that time, I'm able to recall those days quite clearly. Not so long ago, and not so far away, news about women's experiences were covered by journalists who were expected to report on the bizarre behavior of women, such as a female axe murderer, or the traditional behavior of women, such as their presence at flower shows, fashion shows, and charity functions. The word woman was rarely used in reporting, except to describe women of the working class, immigrant women, or members of racial and other minority groups. Ladies, when they appeared in the newspaper, unless in their role as the wife of, the mother of, or some other of, were confined to the women's page or pages. As the someone accompanying a noteworthy male, a woman's name might slip onto some other page. But in any event, whenever she was discussed, there would be a detailed account of what she was wearing, her general appearance, and her relationship to her male companion. These facts were often treated at much greater length than what she said or what she did, even if the latter were more important than the former. The stories on those women's pages were written by women. In many instances, those were the only pages on which the writings of women journalists appeared, because the reporting about women in the media was reflected also in the place which women who worked in the media occupied. There were some exceptions, of course. However, the women who managed to fight free of the women's pages were often so battered and intimidated by the compromises that they had had to make in order to progress in their profession, that they had little time and perhaps less inclination to hold a door to opportunity open long enough for other women to pass through. Or, having arrived, in quotes, they were too insecure to stretch out and pull some other woman up beside them. In those days, the women who by marriage, accident of birth, luck, or struggle made it, were treated by both men and women as exceptions to the rule. They were made to believe that their position could be threatened by the presence of other women in their particular sphere of influence. The word queen bee, which was used to describe such women, has happily almost fallen into disuse today, since as a species, that particular creature seems to be dying out. When the first breath of the women's revolution wafted across North America, it was met with stony silence by the media, a technique which is used against children who are misbehaving. It was this silent treatment which, as is often in the case with children who are misbehaving, led to the outrageous acts which some women and women's groups indulge in, because women were aware that the media just could not resist a good story. So those early stories about the women's movement were really records of the frankly unladylike, undignified, controversial, but riveting behavior of the early feminists. Stand up as, you know, as Linda Hosea does in a male-dominated profession like the media and declare yourself a feminist says a number of things about you. It can say you're brave or it can say you're crazy, you know. But it certainly says that you haven't chosen the easy way out. I just want to say that the reason I've never denied my feminism is because the price was too great to do so. Because denial for me would have meant the loss of self-respect. And I'm not prepared to do that. Finally, the challenges which you face. I fear only one, and that is complacency. I fear that you might fall prey to the myths that the women's movement is dead, that we no longer need to struggle, since anyone can make it in today's world if she only puts her shoulder to the wheel, or to the belief that a right once won is a right secured. So I exhort you to be vigilant. If you believe that we no longer have a need for our revolution, I ask you to read your own news stories about the loss of the rape shield legislation, to read about the ongoing battle for the right to choose in matters of reproduction, to read the statistics on death and violence to which women are subjected every day in this country and around the world. Because as a group, women are sliding backwards. Despite the fact that one may see more female anchor persons and even some female sportscasters, the latest UN report on the condition of women in the world tells us that as a group, we are working harder, growing poorer, and owning less of the world's good and resources than we had before. So if not for yourselves, then for other women, the need remains that your numbers be increased. We need more women in the media. That your influence be increased. We need more women in decision-making in the media. We need more women in the media working on behalf of women. And that your efforts be increased. The challenge facing us as women outside of the media is to be there for you, in solidarity with you, to support your efforts and to strengthen and empower you. Because we are part of a whole, you and us. And if we are to reverse the backward slide, which the UN report revealed, we're going to have to pull harder and we're going to have to pull together on behalf of all of us. Finally, I exhort you, as I do women audiences whenever I address them, to look outwards beyond Canada's borders. The fate of women in this country is tied to that of women in the rest of the world. That observation is no less true of women in the media than it is of women in any other walk of life. So my third and final absolute is that equality will not be achieved by any one of us or some of us in isolation, because we are, for better or worse, our sister. Thank you.
That was Rosemary Brown, a Jamaican-Canadian feminist politician, scholar, writer, and organizer, addressing a conference on women in the media in 1991. The piece was originally produced by WING's co-founder, Catherine Davenport. For Black History Month in February 2009, Canada Post issued a stamp honoring Rosemary Brown. Brown passed away April 26, 2003, at the age of 72. Reporting for WINGS, I'm Frieda Worden. Our email is wings@wings.org. Website, www.wings.org. The WINGS sound logo is from Livana's album, A Circle Is Cast. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps Toward a Gift Economy. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.